This is Mark Steiner. Welcome back. And this is the birthday in 1885 of the great Joseph King Oliver of New Orleans. We'll play a bit of his music during the course of our show today and others great musicians who were born on this day. We are going to tackle the issue of climate change on the way there. I want to remind you the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by the Maryland State Education Association. From school funding to Common Core, you can learn about the important issues affecting Maryland students, parents, and schools by visiting the Maryland State Education Association's website at MarylandEducators.org. That's one word, MarylandEducators.org. Or go to SteinerShow.org and click on their banner, the Maryland State Education Association. We have with us now, Daphne Weisham joins us once again. She is a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies, where she directs the Sustainable Energy and Economy Network and the Genuine Progress Project. The Reverend Meredith Moyes, an ordained minister, writer, community activist, and teacher, and one of the first African-American people ordained within the old Catholic movement in Baltimore. Currently at a clean energy... No, that's not wrong. It's wrong again. Currently, she is working as a clean energy organizer here in Baltimore, and then environmental education and more. And Julia Kumari Drapkin joins us, who is executive producer for I See Change, a crowdsourced climate change reporting project out of Colorado, and our sister station out there. And all of you, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thank you
for having us.
Thank you.
And so this is an interesting piece that we're looking at here. Let me just start this way before we talk about what this report said. When you see these reports come out, and every month, whether it's from the UN or the President's desk, reports are coming out saying climate change is here now. It's not tomorrow. It's not next week. It's not in our child's future, our grandchildren's future. It's happening now. The temperatures are rising. Sea levels are rising. Things are getting colder and wetter in other places and drier in other places. And we're facing this. So you look at all the polls. You look at what people are thinking, and you see that most people agree that climate change is happening. There are a minority of people, certain polls, 15-25%, complete deniers of that. Majority of people who say they vote in the Tea Party world are say this is not happening, but it's a minority of most Americans. But the majority of people, even if they do believe that climate change is among us, is happening to us right now, say that it's not that important an issue. That it is secondary or tertiary to other things that we face. So let me start with Daphne Weisham. I mean, this has been your world for a long time, and I'm curious your analysis of why it is so difficult to have this conversation get started in a broad sense. You even look at this with the Keystone Pipeline, where 64% of Americans say that we want it because I think people are in fear that if we don't have gas and oil, we'll have no energy. So what are your thoughts, Daphne?
Well, I think there's a variety of things at work here. We have both, I would say, a denial that is based in fear of what it means to actually look this monster square in the eye and deal with the potential consequences, both in terms of our own energy consumption, but also in terms of what it means for the rest of the world, because we were, for many decades, the number one emitter of greenhouse gas emissions in the United States. And therefore, we have an enormous responsibility to address this problem and the very serious consequences, as they will play out, harming the poorest in particular, both in the United States and around the world. I think that's one of the issues. The other issue I would say is that we have a problem with scientific literacy in this country. This is very complex science. Scientists are reevaluating how they communicate about climate change. We've got communications professionals working on this problem. It is a challenge to present the data in a way that people can digest and understand. And, of course, the third thing that I would say is absolutely critical in all of this is that we have a professional denial industry that is largely funded by the oil, gas, and coal industry. They have been pushing out misinformation for at least 15 years. They started being very well organized in 1997 or so, and they saw the threat that climate change represented not to the planet, but to their bottom line. And they have been both pulling the strings of politicians, newspaper editorial boards, look at the Wall Street Journal, for example, you name it, on down the road, they are the most powerful industry or one of the most on the planet, and they do not want to go down easily.
Meredith?
I would agree, absolutely. I think it's a delusion based on ignorance. Having worked in climate movement, a lot of the information is, as Sister said, is incredibly complex. And boiling that down to where people can understand can be very hard. And having that information boiled down and accessible can be hard. And I just want to just put out there, as a licensed Christian minister, for some folks, this is kind of like the end of days. So we expect this to happen anyway. And then that becomes a convenient excuse for not doing anything or even addressing the issue because God will take care of it. So there is that stream that runs through certain populations. But, you know, my pushback is always, well, you know, we've been waiting for the return of Jesus for the last 2,000 years. This is not the first generation to face that. So we are charged to be stewards of the earth. We know that. And so we must do something now. And I think it would behoove the climate movement to diversify, first of all, in leadership in terms of gender and ethnicity and race. And it would also behoove the climate movement to really start making this information around extreme weather and climate palatable to the masses. If we have to boil it down to McDonald's speak, the 15-second soundbite, then we need to do that so that people can understand what is at stake.
And so, I'm curious. I mean, you're on the ground doing this special series for KVNF out in Peonia, Colorado. And I'm curious what you feel and see on the ground in that regard.
Right. We started working in Western Colorado and found actually that the climate, you know, understanding of climate change amongst people who don't necessarily believe in climate change is much more nuanced conversation than the climate, you know, debate is in D.C. To think that people don't understand science is a fallacy. People who are Republicans, people who are Democrats, people who live in rural communities are dealing with science every day in their daily lives as ranchers, as farmers, as people who depend on nature for their livelihoods. They deal in science every day in ways that climate journalists like myself do not. So the conversation with them is actually much more nuanced than, you know, than you see reflected in Congress. So 50% of Republicans have seen that the climate has changed, that they're, you know, we are in a different climate environment. As to whether it's man-made is where they draw the line. And if you do look in nature, when you look at the mountains, when you look at the forests, we have dealt with extreme variation and climate change over the history of nature. So they want to know, well, what makes it different now? And that's where we have to be communicating. We're talking about an invisible gas, right? So to think that people are stupid because they don't believe in climate change off the bat is where we fail. The truth is, people are being impacted by climate change every day. And when you look at the numbers in the Pew Research surveys with regards to the priorities of Americans, the top three are jobs, economy, and terrorism. And climate change and extreme weather and climate variability plays into every single one of those at a fundamental level. With regards to the economy, we have a very poor estimates as to how weather and climate affected our economy this last year. The drought in California, the Arctic vortex events, the science and the economics behind that, we are actively trying to figure out and keep up with. And we're not really communicating to the American people that this is affecting their bottom lines at the grocery stores with regards to construction jobs, economic growth. That's where we need to be framing the conversation. Just today, a analyst for the armed forces, for the Navy, came out with a report with regards to the links between our climate change and defense, and in terms of terrorist threats. It's a new report that just came out saying it, instead of climate change being a multiplier with regards to security threats, it is in fact a direct cause for many of the security threats we're seeing in the world today. So in many respects, climate change is in the top three. It's just the way we're framing the conversation.
That's really interesting. I'm the other two guests to wrestle with what you just said for a moment. And look, Meredith, let you go, then we'll go right to Daphne.
Well, I would just push back a little bit in that, in my experience, in particularly urban areas like Baltimore, New York City, and things of that nature, a lot of times people are removed from nature. Mm-hmm. So in terms of that interchange of, well, we know climate is happening, stuff, they think of these things as when there are extreme weather events, but largely for a lot of people in urban areas, they are very removed from nature in terms of actually working outside and things of that nature. So, and I would also say that science education needs to be improved. So if we're talking about education, a lot of times students are not getting the basic information starting in school to understand what's going on. So I would say that, and it also helps that people who are communicating this information also look like the people that they're talking to, which is
absolutely.
You see what
absolutely.
I'm saying? So that's another issue that we do need to deal with in the climate movement. And I think people understand that the weather is crazy, but they don't know what to attribute it to. And a lot of that, you know, because they just don't know. And we need to start creating language around talking about what people do know and helping them bridge those gaps.
Yeah. Absolutely. That's why we're trying to bring the IC Change Project across the country to urban environments as well as rural environments. TheAlmanac.org has been receiving posts from all over the country this last year from Chicago, New York, Texas, and the National Climate Assessment is actually trying to connect the dots for urban environments with regards to our concerns with heat extremes, with regards to infrastructure concerns, with regards to food prices. I mean, the thing about climate change, which is fascinating, is that, you know, it's everywhere local and everywhere global. So where extreme events are happening around the world, it will boil down to what, you know, the prices are at the grocery store. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, communicating amongst urban environments, it's just a framing. It's happening all the time with regards to heating bills, with regards to air conditioning bills that we might be facing this summer, infrastructure issues with extreme precipitation, you know, being stuck in your car during a crazy storm event. Again, all of this stuff is impacting the daily American life.
And Daphne, your thoughts on that?
Yeah, well, I agree with Reverend Moyes. I, you know, there's a big difference between not only the urban and rural identification with what's happening in the natural world, but I agree also that we need to diversify the voices of people that are delivering this message. And I think churches are and communities of faith are going to be absolutely key in delivering this message, because they aren't perceived as being Democrat or Republican. They are largely perceived as being bearers of the truth. Mm-hmm. And so we do need to engage them and engage communities of color in this initiative. But I wanted to actually bring it home to Maryland, if I could. Mm-hmm. Because one of the things that came out of the National Climate Assessment is there's very specific language around what is going to be happening in Maryland in the coming decades. Of course, we'll have heat waves and coastal flooding and river flooding, which will pose a great challenge to the region's environmental and social and economic systems. Julia mentioned, we will have infrastructure is going to be very hard hit in terms of climate-related hazards. I mean, think about, I don't know if you all remember when the temperatures in Washington got so high that the airport's tarmac was melting.
Right,
think about
right.
that happening
mm-hmm. right.
on a regular basis, not only with airport tarmac, but also with train lines. You know, mm-hmm. when you get to a certain temperature, either too hot or too cold, that can affect the rail lines. And, you know, we're increasingly transporting oil, gas, and coal, unfortunately, on our rail lines. So anyway, that's one other issue. The other, of course, is just that sea level rise is going to be dramatic for Maryland. We know from previous reports that have been put out by the Maryland state government that Maryland is at risk of experiencing another 2-foot sea level rise by 2050 and as much as 4-foot sea level rise by 2100. Now, as of yesterday, with the latest news of the West Antarctic ice sheet going into what is called irreversible retreat. Okay, so that what does that word mean, irreversible retreat? That means we are going to see, whether it's over thousands of years or hundreds of years, the Antarctic ice sheet is going to disappear. So what that means is that number that we hold on to of maybe 2 feet or 3 feet or even 4 feet is completely, we have to throw that number up in the air and hope that that's only, it's only going to be 4 feet by 2100. It could be triple that. And if you look at a map of Maryland, of course, you see sea level is just, Maryland is surrounded by the sea. I actually tweeted a map where you can look at sea level rise combined with storm surge. And, of course, storm surge can reach about 30 feet or more. I mean, think of what happened in New York. Think of what's happening right now in Miami with saltwater intrusion into the groundwater. 30 feet or more is possible with a major hurricane. So even if we only had 2 feet or 3 feet of sea level rise, the combined, it's talk about a threat multiplier. I mean, this would just inundate vast areas. The coastal regions of Maryland.
So let's see what our urban and rural listeners think. And suburban. 410-319-8888 is the number here as we wrestle with climate change with three people deeply involved in the world of addressing the issues of climate change in our state, in our country, in our society. Daphne Weisham, Reverend Meredith Moyes, and Julia Komari-Drapkin. Is it Drapkin or Drapkin, Julia?
It's Drapkin, like Drapkin. Napkin. Drapkin, thank
Drapkin,
you
sorry.
So much for asking.
Sorry.
No, it's okay. It's wonderful. And actually, with regards to steam, you know, storm surges and actually wave erosion, people on the almanac.org in Massachusetts, again, we've been hosting conversations now nationwide about the changes they see every day in their backyard, have noticed that waves have been eroding the beaches more, that the storm surge and the wave erosion has increased over time. And so what you're saying with regards to not just sea level rise, but, you know, storm surges is very, very real. I'm actually calling you from New Orleans, Louisiana right now, where we are based. And this problem we're seeing on our coastline down here at a rate that's much faster than anywhere else in the world because we have sea level rise happening on top of wetland loss and subsidence. So our port, Maryland has a very, very important port, so does New Orleans, with regards to our offshore oil and gas production. Our port was named as one of the seven that we're going to be experiencing kind of catastrophic impacts from sea level rise. Our highway is already washing out more regularly than most people know, these infrastructure issues are really where we're going to be feeling some deep pocket pain in the next few decades.
And I think what the three of you are talking about here is so critical because it's for our listeners and those online around everywhere and here in our local area who are listening on the radio to get a sense of the severity of what we're facing. And the fact that all of you have this way of talking about it, I think is important, is that we can do something about it, whether it is this the debate over how we're going to address it by adapting or the fight for real change that sometimes have to go hand in hand just for survival. And this is where it's critical. I think people have to realize we're at a critical stage, and you see so much on like public radio networks that are underwritten by so many large gas companies and other places that that think the opposite. That's why this is so confusing for people, I think. Meredith.
I'm very in light of what you said, and we're talking about storm surges. I just want to point out to our listeners that in Superstorm Sandy, that hit the New York region very hard, a lot of people were affected in this way. So when the power went out and you have these massive housing projects that the elevators stopped working. Mm-hmm. And as a native New Yorker, I know a lot of times, you know, we think we can tough it out or oh, it's just going to rain hard. And what ended up happening was power out for days. People couldn't access their benefits. People couldn't get food. And roving mobs of folks were running up into people's houses, robbing them, stealing food and things of that nature. And, I mean, you know, pitch black hallways always, the whole nine. Mm-hmm. And what I think oftentimes missing in some of these conversations is how climate change affects the least of these. And so when people, you know, are in halls of power, like in Annapolis, in D.C., and in Albany, I wonder if there are people there who are not bringing the conversations like this, who aren't talking about how these things affect the poor and what can we put in place to ensure that people will be able to have what they need when things like this happen. I'm really concerned that those voices aren't there. And so we get situations like this. We get situations like in Annapolis and in Fells Point where people are literally canoeing down the street every time, you know, we have big rainstorms. And these are conversations that need to happen so we can create policy that will move us forward in terms of dealing with climate change.
Let me open the phones here, 410-319-8888. And Russ, you're on the air.
Greetings, Mark, to you and your guests.
Hi, Russ.
Mark, I don't know how much our education system has changed, but I know that somewhere in my junior high school experience, I learned about the oxygen carbon dioxide exchange, that plants, green plants, trees, taking carbon dioxide that then discharges, use it to make chlorophyll, discharges oxygen in return. So just on that simple science alone, and I'm not one of those people that believe that Republican science and Democratic science and left-wing science and all that. The science is simple. Just look at what has happened to Northwest America, Northeast America, the Amazon rainforest, and around the world at the devastation of the grain. And on top of that, we want to talk about fracking, which is a further denuding of the earth, and say to me that it doesn't make sense that that would have an effect on this amassing of carbon dioxide in the air that we're no longer scrubbing out with grain. Why does that not make sense? But my issue is, it's not the science. We're in a capitalist society, and the issue becomes, how do we do the greater good when the greater good has a price tag attached to it and not a profit margin?
All right. And with a little bit of time we have left, let me ask Daphne to tackle that one first. Daphne Wysham.
I'm sorry, the question was what?
Given this capitalist society we're in, how do we begin to even tackle the issues that he was raising?
You know, it's a tough one because we, you know, as we all know, especially in the current political climate with campaign contributions going through the roof and unlimited money in politics, our politics is very skewed in favor of large corporations and the wealthy. We remember the protests around the 1%. Not much has changed since then. I think that this is an issue. It's a complicated issue, but we have to be addressing it on all of the fronts in terms of campaign finance reform, in terms of scientific literacy in our schools, which is, again, another heavily politicized issue where people are teaching that climate change does not exist in some schools. It's a complicated issue, but boy, do we need to get up to speed on this. We have very little time left. And yes, the Antarctic ice sheet is in irreversible decline. But as one of the scientists said, there's a bunch more fuses and a bunch more matches, and we have the decision now. Do we light those as well? Because it's really a question of degree. We can't stop some of the climate change that is underway, but we can avoid the worst effects if we act in the next decade.
Julia?
Yeah, I agree with Daphne, absolutely. I mean, if we stop global emissions now, maybe it buys us 20 years. The reality is we need to start making serious adaptation decisions, and that comes from the political sphere. So let's say, according to the Pew, maybe 50% of Republicans believe that the climate is changing. They may not agree that it's man-made, but they agree that, in fact, the climate is changing. Out of 228 members of the House and the Senate, only 20 Republicans have publicly acknowledged that climate change is real, and not even go delving into the causes. So that's 7%. 7%. In every article you see about climate change, it's no longer that one random scientist, you know, who is the killer quote that says, oh, you know, this isn't being measured correctly. It's a politician who is brought in as that voice, not a scientist. Science is there. It's the politics where we need to be making serious changes with the way we are framing this. This is affecting every American every day, regardless of their politics.
Well, we're just about out of time here. We have 30 seconds, literally, if you want to say something, Meredith. I'm sorry.
I would just say, you know, yes, we know that big oil dominates the communist conversation, things of that nature. But in terms of the climate movement, we have to stop making this idea of adaptation and employing technology that will help us deal with this. We have to stop making it really expensive. You know, I want to drive a Prius, but I can't afford it. So how can we create systems and models that everybody can use and not based on your economic or financial standing?
Well, we'll come back with the three of you in a much longer conversation than this half hour we put on today. And I promise that very soon, because it's important to have voices on here of the environmental movement that are women's voices, that are voices from the communities of color that are going to have to lead this movement and make it work. In this country. I want to thank Daphne Weishaupt once again for joining us, fellow of the Institute for Policy Studies. Daphne, always great to have you on the air with us.
Thank you so much, Mark.
The Reverend Meredith Moy is here, who's currently working in Clean Energy Nonprofit, which organizes communities in Baltimore to purchase clean energy collectively, as an ordained minister and been an activist in our community for a long time. Meredith, good to have you in the studio.
Gracias.
Gracias. De nada. De nada. And Julia Komari-Drapkin, who is executive producer for IC Change. And Julia, let me make a public announcement here, since you're on the air with us, that that IC Change has a home on this show if you want it.
Oh, we're happy to have that home. And we would invite any one of your listeners to post what they've seen change. We're collecting people's observations, questions, and the impacts of climate change across the nation, across color boundaries, across language boundaries. We want to hear from everyone at thealmanac.org. That's www.thealmanac.org.
And we'll be in touch with you to make sure that happens here on the show with us. Thank you so much, the three of you, for joining us here in this half an hour segment.
Bye-bye.
All those reports and ideas will be on our website at steinershow.org. I want to remind all of you that listen to our program and listen to our sound bites every Tuesday about the future of the environment, food, and our society. You can join us tomorrow night for a larger discussion about food in our community, city, and region at 7 o'clock at the Central Branch of the Enoch Pratt Library. It'll be a larger discussion about how our food is being taken over by industrial agriculture and how we can reclaim it. We're going to be talking with Christopher Leonard, the man who wrote The Meat Racket, The Secret Takeover of America's Food Business. And you can just join us there at 7 or call for more information, 443-804-1252. Tomorrow at Enoch Pratt Library, 7 o'clock, Central Branch. Join us there for an incredible conversation. Be part of the discussion. Stay with us. We'll be right back with the next part of the Mark Steiner Show. Don't go away.